Cliff Central Revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Just after 1 p.m., we're about to get started with your favorite hour of the day. I will be riding solo sort of today. Greg, my partner in crime, is in Ethiopia living his best life. So hopefully he'll come back with some stories, maybe some coffee. Actually, before we get started, I just wanted to say thank you to all of you. We were reviewing the numbers over the weekend and just looking at the Twitter engagements. And it's just been wonderful to see the reception of people listening to shows, downloading shows, sharing shows, and it's been incredible. We were commemorating over the weekend the one-year anniversary of the Garissa attacks in Kenya. And just people going back to that episode and sharing that and remembering that, you know, over 140 people that were killed. So it's just thank you for helping us sort of spotlight issues like this and try to sort of dig deeper. Also, we finally gave away the book for Richard Poplack and Kevin Bloom. We had a stiff competition for people who were engaging with us on that episode, and that's been given to one lucky listener. And we launched Greg Marinovich's book on the Marikana massacre. So it's been a busy couple of weeks with the Daily Maverick team. Whew, okay. Now to focus on this week. We'll be talking about this sort of field or world that a lot of people don't know too much about. And I've been hearing a lot of words I don't understand, like social entrepreneurship, social impact bonds. And there seems to be new creative ways that people are finding to fund social good. So we want to dig into this. Why does the nonprofit sector exist at all? Why are nonprofits struggling to stay open and stay alive? And lastly, what are some clever ways that are emerging in which they can get funded? To dig into this, I have someone in studio who's much more qualified than me on the topic, Karen Krakowitzer of Capacitate. Karen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
If you just step a bit closer to the mic and be right in front of it. All right, let's try this again. Karen?
Pleasure.
All right. She's with us. Karen, I mean, now you're a development consultant, you work with nonprofits, you work with corporate, but I'd like to just go a bit further back and start with, you know, you in the sector yourself. Now, you used to run a nonprofit organization, didn't you?
That's correct.
Could you tell us a bit about that? What did it do?
Yes, sure. The nonprofit organization was called NOAA. It was a large South African child protection NGO. And I led it some years ago, whilst simultaneously developing a sustainability trust that existed alongside it in order to provide for the future of the organization. NOAA was really interested in developing community-based child protection organizations that would look after the needs of vulnerable children in those communities. And it did that by establishing what it named ARCS. And yes, it was an interesting time for all.
I mean, I'm curious. You mentioned sort of centers where orphans can be safe. And I mean, that when the second you described that, it sounds to me like a government function. Why did this gap exist? Why wasn't this being provided for to begin with?
Well, I think that the state continues to perform less of the functions that it should be and is withdrawing from many areas of social support. I think focus areas change from time to time. And also, often, the funding policies of governments are very tightly controlled by the Public Finance Management Act with little to no wiggle room. So it's quite difficult to align exactly with what government's able to spend on. I also think that corporates are ever tightening and refocusing the impact areas that they wish to support. And again, we're seeing shifts in trend. So there are gaps that open up all the time for civil society to step in.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, just to understand more about NOAA, could you give us an idea of the size? How many orphans were in your care? How many ARCs did you sort of fund and support? Just to get an idea of how big this was.
Sure. Well, obviously it was different sizes at different times.
Yeah.
At the height of my tenure, we had over 400 permanent staff members. Yeah. We had 700 to 800 volunteers. We were probably serving about 112 communities, so it was a big organization.
How many young people would you sort of estimate were in the care of the ARCs? I mean, I say estimate because I can imagine. Yeah,
yes.
You say 112 communities.
It was 28,000 or so.
28,000?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, Karen, I mean, you've been referring to NOAA in the past tense. NOAA isn't sort of no longer there. And I'd love if you could just run us through, you know, what happened. 28,000 people in your care. I mean, crucial services. We're talking about, you know, orphans in really vulnerable communities.
Mm.
What happened?
Well, NOAA was the recipient of a very large international grant, which came to an end in 2012. At that time, every indication pointed to the fact that NOAA would receive further funding in terms of a new grant from the same funder, and then it didn't. Simultaneous to that, NOAA was busy implementing a new strategy, and so there was a lot of change that all happened at the same time. And unfortunately, as a result of this reduction in income, which accounted for nearly two-thirds of the expenditure of the whole organization, NOAA needed to structure a grant closeout, so it effectively scaled back a significant portion of its operation at that time. I think in the region of 320 staff were retrenched, and financial support was withdrawn from around 67 ARCs, which supported in the region of about 11,000 vulnerable children. And, yeah, a little bit later, and I wasn't actually heading up the organization at this time, but there was a final decision taken to close the organization after nearly 13 years of operation.
I mean, I'm just, like, I keep sitting on this sort of 28,000 figure, and you're mentioning retrenching 300 out of 400 people. I mean, how does that happen? How does two-thirds of the organization's budget just not be there anymore? I mean, you say the indications were there that it was going to be refunded and it wasn't.
Yes.
Is that, how does that happen?
Well, I think it's about, perhaps a mismatch of understanding or expectations. I think it's about not having things committed to in writing. It's about living in hope. and then it's about things not coming to fruition and also having too many eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
I think there were lots of lessons that we learned through that story, you know, around over-reliance on one donor. In our case, we also had a rainmaker, someone within the organization who had the ability to pull in money in a much more profound way than many others. And I think certainly what I learned by being exposed to the process of watching NOAA close down is that when times are tough, friends are definitely few. also, reserve building, which we all know is easy in theory, is quite hard in practice. And when challenging times come along, reserves are whittled away very quickly. The other thing is that sustainability strategies really take time. You know, we think that if you get a business going or set up some kind of income generation activity, that that's going to sustain you. But in order for it to become big enough to make a significant impact in your budget and to be able to replace a sufficient portion of your income, you really need to provide years and years in order to get it right.
I mean, I hear you, Karen, and I'm just trying to think of the sort of scale of this. I mean, so we're talking about one organization that you were leading, 28,000, you know, young people in your care. And what has felt for me, at least, with some involvement in the nonprofit space, is that there seems to be a high rate of nonprofits closing in the past, shall we say, 4 years, 3 years. I mean, some are attributing it to sort of the global financial crisis and sort of the knock-on effect of that. But there was also the sort of the large withdrawal of American funding that happened a few years ago. So, I mean, are you getting a sense that nonprofits are sort of less stable in the past couple of years or less likely to stay open? There seems to be sort of something going on at a macro level.
Yes, no, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
I think global economic pressures have played a huge role in creating instability in the sector. I think that there's definitely a reduction in the availability of funding, both locally and internationally, as a result of economic conditions. Definitely, our organizations are under increasing pressure to diversify their revenue sources and to optimize their operations, really for lean efficiency. And on the other hand, we have increasing competition. You know, our social needs seem to just keep getting bigger. There are more of them all the time. I was just looking at some stats this week in terms of the number of registered non-profit organizations in the country at the moment, and I'd always had it in my mind that there were around 100,000 of them registered with the non-profit directorate of the Department of Social Development, and it seems like it's closer to 150,000 rand. Sorry, not rand, 150,000 organizations, which is huge. So, you know, where are they getting their funding from? How are they complementing each other? I guess what this speaks to is the need to focus on collaboration and partnership and bringing work closer and closer together and not to keep on setting up new entities.
I mean, I hear you. Now, you had sort of started jumping into things we can learn from your experience, from NOAA's experience, and from the experience of other nonprofits that were really serving vulnerable communities that were performing really essential functions that the country needed. And I mean, firstly, credit to you for being able to take what was, I can imagine, a very painful and difficult experience and being able to still find lessons in that and pass them on.
Thank you.
I mean, secondly, you had started talking about them and you were mentioning things like reserves. You were talking things about sustainability. So what's, if you could just go back to that, what are some lessons that you think existing nonprofits could learn from your experience?
I think that, you know, another big lesson for me was that an organization can only weather so much change at one time.
Okay.
And so the fact that we were trying to, scale down the organization in size in response to the ending of that grant, and we were trying to implement a new strategy all at the same time, it was probably all a bit much for an organization that had been through a fairly serious amount of trauma. I think that the boards really need to step up to the plate when it comes to sustainability strategies as well. I have seen, and I'm now working quite a lot with organizations and helping them think through their sustainability planning. The quality of boards in this country, in the nonprofit sector is not all that high. And really, the board plays a critical role in helping an organization, you know, think broadly, move quickly, and really to be able to execute its plan. So board support is key. I think that nonprofit organizations need to make sure that they don't initiate sustainability activities too late. As I said before, it really does take time to fill the gaps in terms of income should any money come to an end. And when doing sustainability planning, it's really important to factor in short-term, medium-term, and long-term opportunities and not just focus on the long-term ones or just on the short-term ones. We need to have a spread of activities. And perhaps some other learnings, if I may, when it comes to the funding of activities, I think that funders and development practitioners have a few things that they can learn from the NOAA story as well. Firstly, it's really beginning with the end in mind,
okay.
Knowing that you're not going to support an organization into perpetuity. At some point, you know, you're going to want to move on and you're going to want to leave them in a position better than when you joined them. And so it's really, you know, building those exit strategies from the start and making sure that you're providing for sustainability thinking and not just helping think through sustainability initiatives, but also to dedicate sufficient time and resources to partners to enable them to explore sustainability activities so that you're able to leave a legacy when you go and that you're not creating a gap or a hole that can't be filled and inevitably facilitating the closure of an organization.
Okay, you mentioned a lot, so I'm just going to try sort of dig into some of the things you've mentioned. What's underpinning this, it sounds to me, is this idea that financial sustainability needs to be a crucial part of leading a nonprofit organization. Not just providing your direct services, but directing resources, manpower, and sort of leadership attention to an organization's financial sustainability. I mean, I think that's just worth mentioning in itself, because I imagine if my job is to, you know, provide food to areas where there's food scarcity, to provide water to areas where there's drought, I would build my organization to do that.
Yes.
And what you're saying is that's not enough. You have to be able to do that, but at the same time, think through how can you make sure that you're able to do that in the long term. So I think that sounds like already a shift in thinking, where it's not enough to just be like, we're good at thing X and this is how we do it. There's now another level of how do we make sure we're continuously able to do this.
Exactly.
Jeez, how... this idea you're mentioning of doing this from the beginning. So what you're almost describing is that if you're running out of money and you're trying to scramble and trying to plug holes, it sounds like it's already too late.
Can't be.
And that's a really sort of worrying thing to think of, because, I mean, in any situation, not just in nonprofits, when money's tight, you start thinking about the money more.
That's right.
And you're saying, no, when it's the time of feast, not just the time of famine, you already need to be thinking about financial sustainability.
Often in my facilitations, I use the analogy of Noah's Ark, just because it's a universal story that that everyone knows of, and there's no relationship, obviously, to the arcs of my Noah. But you know, the truth is that in that story, The ark was built in the sunshine, long before the storms arrived and the first raindrops started falling. And that was what enabled Noah to build an ark that was big enough to ultimately save humanity. Had they started building the ark, you know, closer to when the storms were due to arrive, they might not actually have managed to build an ark at the end of the day. It could have been something more like a lifeboat that, you know, saved two or three animal species and that was it.
Yeah.
The critical message there is just that this is something that requires planning, and you have to provide for the bad times during the good times. Because if you wait for the bad times to arrive, it's more than likely going to be way too late.
I can't put it any better than that, Karen. If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central, in studio with Karen Krakowitzer from Capacitate. And we're just talking about the non-profit sector, exploring some sort of really tragic stories of really important non-profits around the country that have unfortunately had to close down due to lack of funding. And we're trying to learn from that. What are they doing wrong? What could they have done better? And what is this thing around financial sustainability? I mean, everybody knows we need more money, but how do you make that happen? How do you structure it? How do you save in advance? And how do you build the ark while the sun is shining, as Karen puts it? Karen, I mean, I'd love to hear an example of an organization that's doing this well. I mean, when you're describing this, it sounds really complicated. You're talking about having the board right, thinking in advance, building this in advance. If you just explain to me, what does this look like, financial sustainability? What does it look like when it's working well?
You know, I'd be loath to give specific examples of organizations that are doing a good job of it, because there's so many of them.
Sure.
And I think it's really about organizations that, you know, are obviously subsidizing their nonprofit or their social work that needs to be, you know, a service that's given away with services that are income generating and that enable them to continue their work without creating dependency on funders. And, many organizations doing great things. I think very often what happens is that they set up businesses alongside the work that they're actually doing that either complement their existing services or are completely separate. I've seen examples on both sides.
Okay.
So sometimes they invest in shares in other companies in order to be able to create some kind of dividend flow. So perhaps I can give you some examples without mentioning names there. But, you know, I know of a non-profit organization, for example, that runs a school for previously disadvantaged children that have learning challenges. And what they've done in order to sustain that work is to set up an FET college that enables them to attract income that then subsidizes the work that they're doing in the school. So that would be one good example.
Okay.
An example of an organization that has...
Sorry, if I could just stop on that. So the school you're mentioning, is that this is a free or close to free school, I'm assuming,
that's correct.
A non-profit runs. And then you set up an FET college.
Correct.
And you charge, you run that just as you would a business.
Exactly.
And you charge and whatever, it's super professional, and then you use the profits from the FET college to fund the school.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's a clever model because the FET college is obviously affiliated to all of the CETAs. It's got all the relevant BEE credentials. It attracts support from corporate. It's able to provide enterprise development, you know, return on investment and things like skills development, return on investment, etc. And so, you know, it's quite an attractive proposition for anyone who wants to support that, whether it be putting their own staff through the institution or perhaps just youth that, you know, they would like to see having a better life.
Okay.
But ultimately, it's earning a profit that enables this organization to sustain the work being done in the school for these people with learning challenges.
Absolutely. And I love that it's still in the same field.
Yeah.
So it's not now trying to figure out how to build, you know, bicycles. It's saying we are already doing education. We have some sort of core competencies in the education space and sort of leveraging that to make a bit of money.
Exactly. It can happen, however, that you do something that's completely unrelated to what you do as your core business. So, for example, I've seen another organization that works with foreign nationals in the inner city, and they provide products in the form of fertilizers and other agricultural related items, you know, to the market in partnership with one of their ex-funders. So they've just forged a partnership based on a strong relationship and have been able to create an entire business around that that's completely unrelated to what they do.
So it sort of works both ways. And yeah. I was singing the praises of doing, of sort of, I don't say minding your own business, but we're focusing on the stuff you know. But it sounds like there's still clever ways to
get around that.
To get around that.
And another example that has just come to mind is an organization that decided to buy shares in a company. And it works with people that are quadriplegic. And it bought shares in a company that manufactures wheelchairs. I mean, how smart is that? So you're actually now able to control to some extent an organization that is providing product that you're going to need on a daily basis, and you're making a profit in the process through dividends.
It sounds like there's a lot of options here, and I'm looking forward to actually dividing and sort of digging up the differences before confusing myself and saying we could buy shares, we could also start a business, because it sounds like there's just sort of so many opportunities and only so much sort of time and funding and capacity.
Sure.
Okay. If you're just listening in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're just going to go into a really short break and then we'll be right back. Exploring some of these alternative income opportunities that Karen is describing, looking at social entrepreneurs and how they're funding their work, and looking at clever things like buying shares in companies. How does that work? I mean, I can barely do it for myself. I wonder how it works for non-profits to do it. We'll be right back in just a few minutes.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Just about halfway through the show, we're talking about this thing called the non-profit and the different and creative ways that people are funding the social good, the shortcomings of sort of the traditional charity way of doing things, and looking at, we've got great challenges in this country around inequality, around disenfranchised communities and people, and saying how do we generate the money to do the things that we know need to get done. I'm joined in studio by Karen Krakowitz of Capacitate, who has a lot of experience not only running a non-profit but in advising existing ones on how to pay for stuff, how to keep the lights on, and how to keep the communities they're working with sort of receiving the essential services. Karen, you mentioned just before we went into the break a lot of clever and creative ways that nonprofits are exploring to fund the really important work they're doing. And as you were talking, I was really stuck and confused about how to decide. I'm here and I'm running my important nonprofit work. I'm caring for the elderly. I'm providing food for drought areas, and you're saying that I could do anything basically, whether limited to my mission or in a different field or scope altogether. How do I decide? How do I explore and think through the different avenues I could explore to fund the important work I'm doing?
I think it begins with a look at your organization's own strengths and assets, because if you can align what you do every day with what you want to do in order to, you know, generate alternate income opportunities, it does make life a lot easier.
Okay.
So I would certainly say begin with you know, what you've got. And perhaps it is useful for me at this point to just give a few examples around how one can do that.
Mm.
So, you know, there's simple ways that one can look at it. You know, you could do an asset mapping exercise where you look at everything that you have in place and say, well, how could this be used to better effect? So you could look at your office space, for example, and say, well, could we rent out surplus office space in order to generate an income?
Mm.
Or you could look at your products and services and say, well, we're currently giving them away, but could we be selling them, actually? So in many instances, we see nonprofit organizations packaging up their training materials for different audiences and charging for their use, for example. In some instances, people will start to sell their research instead of giving the research away. Maybe you've got a fleet of vehicles that can be used for alternate purposes. So it's really about saying, what do we have and how could it be used differently to how we're using it currently? Then there are more complex ways that you can be looking at this and sort of saying, well, can we take our entire program or a large portion of it and almost commercialize it? So, for example, I've been working with a large, almost regarded as a public health facility that's providing services currently to people that can't afford health services. And having a look at, you know, whether a portion of their operation could be commercialized and perhaps marketed again through a rebranding exercise to perhaps a different audience that can afford to pay, you know, linking it into medical aids, et cetera, that sort of thing. So there's definitely a lot that one can do to kind of rethink, you know, large aspect of what you are currently doing. You know, if you are operating as a distribution channel at the moment as an organization, why could you not use that same distribution channel to supply other product or other services, you know, at a fee? You could start a completely new business if you didn't have any ideas for how you could convert existing assets or strengths into opportunities, for sure. And then, of course, owning shares would be, you know, another option if that was something that you felt that you had the know-how and the ability to coordinate.
I mean, just as you're talking, it sort of occurs to me that isn't there a worry about getting distracted from the core work? I mean, if I'm doing thing X, and now I'm all of a sudden I'm trying to, you know, use my fleet of vehicles to deliver packages on the weekend, and that's bringing in money, and my co-work doesn't bring in money. Is there a worry that it might dilute the quality of the services, or that it may just be, it would just take up, you know, precious time and resources that could be used on the co-work?
Look, there's always going to be a concern like that. I think it's like any other change management process. If we compare this to the business world, for example, as soon as you start introducing new lines, new divisions, new products, you know, there's always that risk. So it's really about how you place those new things into your overarching strategy and make sure that they are provided for and managed in the best and most effective manner. Certainly, once a business or an income generating activity becomes large enough to warrant having its own leadership, that's definitely a consideration.
Okay.
But I mean, certainly when nonprofit organizations are just trying their hand at a few new little things, you would house it within the same entity that you're doing all of your social work, and you would just kind of grow it gently within there until it warranted having its own focus.
Okay. So the second you need to have a sort of head of fleet management for income generation and titles like that, that's a time when it might be worth sort of relooking at the structure.
Yes, like. and possibly it's actually the legal entity that the structure is housed in as well. So you might want to be spinning it out of the non-profit organization and into something that's a little bit more commercial in structure.
I mean, the secondly is, and I don't mean to be the ultimate black hat in this conversation, it's just, I mean, the stats on a lot of small businesses and micro enterprises is that they don't survive, they don't last very long. And, you know, and very few of them make it out of the 5 years. Does that apply to small businesses that are sort of set up as part of non-profit activity? Are they more or less likely to succeed? Because I wonder if it's already so hard, will it not overtax the existing work?
Look, I think that, you know, a new business within a non-profit entity has got all the same exposure as any new business in the commercial space. So you would need to think through it in the same way as you would any kind of commercial activity. You want to do your business planning, your feasibility analysis, your stakeholder analysis. You want to understand who your target market is. You want to make sure that the items are profitable. So, no, there's no reduction in risk, you know, unless you've been able to kind of secure your go-to-market through perhaps one of your existing partners or something like that. So, I think it has to be thought through very carefully, and I think you want to obtain the right advice and counsel from the right sorts of people, and you want to rely on your board and make sure that, you know, you've got good, solid support and networking around what it is that you're going to be doing.
Okay. I wish I could just scribble all that stuff down. That sounds like the ultimate sort of checklist or how-to guide. Karen, I mean, a word that I've been coming across a lot is this idea of social enterprise and social entrepreneurship. We've been talking about sort of alternate income generation. And I'm curious, is it the same thing? Is it different? What is a social enterprise? Is it just any nonprofit that's bringing in money? Is it a for-profit company that's doing sort of social goodish work? What is this word and what does it mean?
What comes first, the chicken or the egg? Ultimately, a social enterprise is a financially sustainable business. So it's almost the business that comes first, I guess. But, you know, if you developed the nonprofit organization first and you're now wanting to convert it into a business, that's possible as well.
Okay.
But it needs to be a financially sustainable business where profits, if any, are reinvested to address social problems. And that's really the nuts and bolts of it. So the social purpose is the primary objective. But the business model must be financially sustainable, and critical here is that it's not for individual gain.
So it sounds like it's a fairly broad term, and just says, are you financially sustainable, and is your vision, is your mandate really centered around some kind of creating a sort of positive social change in some sense? So it sounds like it can take different forms. Is that fair to say that a for-profit company can be a social enterprise, a non-profit company can be a social enterprise? Am I getting you correctly?
Yeah, it is very broad, and there are definitely a lot of different forms that it can take. And it might be that you begin with the social focus and that you develop the business focus later, or it might be that you have a business focus. And I've seen this happen before as well. It was actually in the context of an advertising agency.
Yeah.
Had the business focus and then suddenly decided actually they wanted to remodel and repurpose themselves entirely for a social mandate. And so it can go that way around too.
I mean, I'm really fascinated by this idea of a for-profit business really centering on this social, creating positive social change. I mean, just when I think of capitalism at its sort of rawest form, that just seems ridiculous. So, I mean, I'm curious to hear more about that, perhaps that particular agency or other sort of stories you've come across where a for-profit business either changes along the way or is actually just set up to provide sort of social positive social outcome, shall I say.
Yeah.
Where is this coming from and where have you seen this happen?
So I think it really just boils down to the individuals that are involved, you know. It would be around someone who's sort of perhaps run a business for some time and has achieved what they've needed to achieve, made the money that they've needed to make, and then decide that actually, you know, they want to live their life in a different way and to kind of reorganize their world in alignment with a calling, and then decide that they will take people on the journey with them that are prepared to support that, and then kind of work backwards from there.
And that's incredible. And I've been hearing more and more, I don't say wider, or even creative definitions of really understanding what positive social outcomes are. And I had a friend who a couple of weeks ago was trying to explain to me why Uber is actually a social enterprise. And they were trying to explain to me that if we own less cars and more people are using Uber, all of a sudden you've got less congestion in inner cities. You've got lower pollution and emission of carbon, sort of carbon from cars. And that's a really, really big contributor towards global warming. It's just vehicles and our insistence that everybody must have their own car, which is absolutely not necessary.
Sure.
And they were trying to convince me that Uber's a social enterprise. And in my mind, I was like, no, it can't be. Uber has billions in the bank that they're just blowing all over the world, expanding at 6 times every year. So in my mind, it was just so difficult to understand that. But at the same time, I found it hard to counter, because despite the for-profit motive, one could argue that there are really creative ways at creating social good and positive outcomes
sure.
for the
it's
world.
It's almost like there's a social spin-off. Yeah.
I like that spin-off. I'm sure there's a lot. I'm sure Uber, we had the GM of Africa, I think, Alon Lutz, on the show a few weeks ago. I think he'd love the idea that Uber just sort of has a Mother Teresa approach to getting us where we need to go.
Exactly.
I mean, Karen, just to bring you back, thanks for defining this idea of a social enterprise. And I'm curious about the last thing you mentioned, which was this idea you mentioned that some companies own shares or some nonprofit organization own shares. How does that work? How does a nonprofit then own shares in another company and how does that work?
You know, all of these things are quite complicated and they can take different forms and there are many different structures in which one can hold, you know, different types of sustainability activity. Very often organizations that are wanting to go into the ownership space and to hold shares establish separate sustainability vehicles in order to do so. I can give you an example or two of
Yeah, please, because this idea of, when you say vehicle, I feel like we're not, we're talking about Uber, I'm not confused. What do you mean by sustainability?
So a sustainability vehicle would be a separate entity that sits alongside the nonprofit organization that has different leadership and different credentials that enable it to participate in business activity, but where there's a passive income stream that's set up to flow directly to the nonprofit organization. And perhaps it would be best explained by way of example. So one of the bigger ones that I know relates to Love Life, the youth-based HIV initiative it's sort of an awareness campaign, I guess, that we've known for many, many years in the country. They established many years ago an organization called the Kurasani Love Life Trust. So it was a trust. It was completely separate to Love Life, but the sole beneficiary was Love Life. And Kurasani was set up in order to be able to participate, particularly in renewable energy deals when those started emerging in the country. And effectively, it's participating as a broad-based black economic empowerment owner and is able to participate as the black shareholder in BEE deals. And so Kurasani has racked up many shares over time in various projects, developments, and companies, and is able to now earn dividends off of those shares that enable it to provide a sort of annuity income stream to Love Life on an annual basis. Quite a complicated structure, but something that has proven to be very successful. And another example in this vein is Ditikeni Investment Company Limited, who are based in Cape Town. They also participate in many share deals, except that they don't exist to support one non-profit organization. They've got a number of shareholder beneficiaries that they provide support to. So they operate as almost an investment vehicle that's managing shares on behalf of numerous non-profit organizations doing important work in the country. And at the end of the year, when they've wrapped up their financials and they know how much they've got to distribute, everyone benefits in direct proportion to the number of shares held.
I mean, this sounds, I mean, as you said, complicated, but also just really fascinating. Okay. So there's some kind of deal going on, whether it's a sale or a company going public. It sounds like there's a lot of sort of scope there. And then if a company needs a certain amount of sort of black-owned shares, rather than approach individuals, they go to a non-profit and
say, exactly it.
You own these shares.
Yeah.
And then from then on, they can get dividends from the company and so on. That sounds like a tremendous opportunity. I feel like more people should know about this. Where's the, I don't know, the take a lot of the Craigslist for these sort of opportunities?
Well, look, I think that it requires clever structuring. It takes a lot to set this sort of thing up. You need the right kinds of people involved to be at the coal face. You need to have people that are in the know when it comes to, you know, the sourcing of these deals and how to put them all together. It definitely takes some upfront investment. And then obviously there are different ways.
I imagine you need some investment bankers and somebody in the room on your side just to understand the what you're getting into. I mean,
definitely.
I'd be terrified signing that contract if I didn't know.
No, you would. So, I mean, this is where you start to rely heavily on board members and members of your network in order to be able to bring the different skills to bear that would be required to see any one of these deals through. And of course, the structuring can look quite different from one deal to the next as well. It might be that in some instances the shares are donated to the nonprofit organization. In other instances, it might be that they are sort of financed and then you would pay them back out of dividends. In other instances, you know, you would perhaps be able to pay back later. There's just lots of different ways in which this whole thing can play out. And so you definitely need people that are in private equity or are, you know, squarely placed in the finance space to be able to advise on the structuring.
Okay. Sorry, if you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Thank you for everybody who's tweeting in. I see you and I'm trying to make it all happen. If I don't apply to your tweet, just, you know, tweet at Greg Nicholson and tell him if he spent less time, you know, holidaying in Addis and more time in the studio, you might have somebody to tweet. But just going to the last portion of the show, and I'm still exploring and trying to fumble my way through this topic about how we can fund social good and creative ways we can find to really tackle some of the really great challenges the country faces us. And what are some clever ways we can put money where it's most needed, in the most sort of vulnerable spaces and most vulnerable communities. Karen, you've mentioned this thing, and we were sort of talking about it over email before, and you were saying this idea of investment vehicles, endowment vehicles, and there was now this thing of social impact bonds came up. And I was literally like, I have no idea what this is. I barely understand the basic bond on, and now it's a social impact bond, and how does that work?
Wow. Well, firstly, just to say that social impact bonds are relatively new financing mechanisms. I think that worldwide there are probably only about 50 of them in operation, which is not that many. In Africa, we have literally just launched the very first instances of social impact bonds, and so we're still to really wait and see how that all is going to play out. In our country at the moment, Bertha Center at the UCT Graduate School of Business has really taken the lead in this area. And on the 18th of March, they announced, in partnership with the Western Cape Departments of Health and Social Development, that we would be launching three new social impact bonds in Africa. They are really focused on improving health, nutrition, and developmental status of pregnant women and children. So that's the outcome that they're hoping to achieve through the launch of these social impact bonds. But to your question, a social impact bond is really a contracting and a financing mechanism that has been designed to drive better social outcomes. Typically, they are established in partnership with governments. And effectively, they work by attracting socially motivated investors, normally from the private sector, to fund social services upfront. So they pay for the services upfront. And then repayments to these investors are made by government and sometimes private funders as well, if pre-agreed outcome targets are achieved. But here's the key. They need to be independently verified. So you actually need someone like an auditor to sit outside of the structure and to make sure that if you say that this particular outcome is going to be achieved, that it is in fact achieved. And then what happens is that the government would repay the investor based on the hitting of that target. Sometimes if they hit all their targets, they can be paid a premium, so they can actually earn a bonus for having hit all the targets. And sometimes if they don't hit their targets, then the amount that they get paid is either discounted or is actually not paid back at all.
Wow.
So effectively, the risk then falls to the investor to make sure that those outcomes are in fact achieved.
So we need to find something that's, I'm assuming, something quite big to require this kind of financing. You set up a bond, corporate puts in some money up front and says we're going to put up, I don't know, R1 billion for these specific outcomes. That R1 billion is then available to be spent on the good stuff. Provided those things are hit, government pays the investor back, potentially with a premium, depending on how well it went.
That's it.
Okay. Who's at the center of this? Is that the nonprofit?
Yeah, so you've got a program operator that sits in the middle that's actually doing the work. But there's another body as well, which is an intermediary that kind of holds it all together. They're responsible for operating as exactly that, an intermediary, and communicating between all parties, setting up the contracting, making sure that the results and the indicators are in fact being measured, and then ensuring that the funds flow, once the results have been verified.
Okay, so it's only a couple of people in the room. I imagine this is another example where it helps to have some kind of perhaps finance or banking or legal expertise on one's board, on one's team, just to be a part of explaining and understanding what's going on.
Most definitely.
Okay. Karen, in our conversation, just as we came in, you mentioned an organization called Project Isizwe that's really explored this sort of innovative space or cutting edge of financing social good that we're talking about. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I think perhaps just to sort of frame the discussion, there are many, many types of innovative social finance that exist. It would be too difficult, almost impossible, to discuss them all. Every deal or every new instance of social finance takes its own flavor and looks different to the one that took place before it. But I thought that, in trying to explain how things could be structured differently, it might be useful to look at an example of an organization that has been trying to see how finance can be used to their benefit with different degrees of impact actually being achieved. So Project Isizwe is an organization that's been rolling out free Wi-Fi networks across the country. You may have heard of the Free Tswane Wi-Fi project. That's a network that's been deployed by Project Isizwe. Their principal focus is on deploying free Wi-Fi through public spaces in really low-income communities. They are primarily funded by government. If we think about the merits of connecting people to the internet, it's not difficult to realize that, there are a lot of social benefits that come as a result of connecting people to the internet. Things like boosting economic development, improving education, lifting people out of poverty, connecting them to jobs, improving social inclusion and making people feel connected, that sort of thing. However, that can be quite a difficult thing to prove. So, Project Isizwe, and I know because I've been working with them over time, has explored different ways of thinking through what kinds of models might be applied in their context. And what we sort of looked at was that there were different structures. You could look at an outputs-based structure versus a results-based structure. And finally, an outcomes-based structure, which would be closer to the social impact bond that we described just now. But if we recognize that there are numerous proof of concepts and numerous research papers that explain the benefits of connecting people to the internet, then we know that there is a notional impact if we connect people to the internet. And on an outputs basis, Isizwe could simply connect communities to a free Wi-Fi network and be deemed to be having an impact. Does
absolutely.
That make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the impact funder in an outputs-based finance model would simply pay project assessees where as base stations go live or people actually connect to the network.
Okay. So every person you sign up, we give you whatever.
Well, yeah, exactly. It would be something like that.
Amount of rent, yeah.
If you took it up a notch and you wanted to look at results, you could say, okay, well, Project Assessware is not only connecting communities to the free Wi-Fi network, but they're also starting to offer value-added services across the network that contribute to meeting specific socioeconomic needs. And so what the impact funder in a results-based model would say is that it would pay on delivery and uptake of content. So it's not good enough just to connect individuals to the network, but you now want to see them actually using some of the content that's being delivered across the network. So an example of that might be that if Project Assessware has uploaded a matric tutorial, you want to see that people are actually downloading the tutorial.
Okay, so not everybody's on YouTube just watching cats, I don't know, some cats playing with yarn videos. They're actually doing what's deemed to be sort of socially beneficial for their sort of...
Exactly, okay. And they've now actually gone and accessed it and pulled it down. So there's a level of consumption, if that makes sense. And then the third level would be something that's more like a social impact bond, which speaks to outcomes-based financing. And that would be to take it to the next level and say, well, as a result of having downloaded that matric tutorial, we are in fact seeing an improvement in matric pass rates.
Jeez. Okay.
So it's really about what you're able to measure.
Okay. It sounds like there's a lot going on here, and I'd love if we could get the guys from Project Assessware in studio one of these weeks. Karen, we're just going to the last portion of the show, and I'd love to speak a bit about your work. So for everyone listening in, it's no secret that she knows her stuff and she knows what's going on and is really able to guide a lot of nonprofits or social enterprises or funders or government bodies through this murky world of understanding your BEE and where you stand, understanding your outcomes and where you stand, and of course, trying to be financially sustainable and sort of overall sustainable. So Karen, you've developed a book, I'm holding it right now, it says Building Organizational Sustainability, a Handbook for Civil Society Organizations. Could you tell us a bit about sort of this book, and I'm told it's an accompanying tool, and how it works and how you sort of see it growing from here?
Yeah, sure. We developed the book really to enable organizations to take themselves through a process of learning about various domains of organizational sustainability. It was developed in direct partnership or alongside the development of an online self-assessment tool. And really the intention was for an organization to firstly assess itself using the online tool to understand, you know, what gaps exist from a sustainability point of view, and to be able to, as a result of the gaps, identify capacity development actions that would need to be implemented in order to get it closer to a place of being more sustainable. And this online tool kicks out a series of actions and ideas around what could be done in order to move closer to that place of sustainability. And it, in fact, makes reference to the handbook and exactly where you can go and read up about how to implement those things within the organization. I must say that much of the credit needs to go to USAID, who supported the development of much of the sustainability content and thinking through its PEPFAR program. But the final wrap-up was done in partnership with the Deutsche Bank South Africa Foundation, who supported us in being able to really tighten up all the content and to be able to launch this book and the online tool that's linked to it.
Okay. I mean, it sounds really like just a one-stop shop, not only for the finances, but all the other aspects. I mean, just looking through it, it touches on so many key things, from supplying the key sort of inputs that one needs to recruitment, to governance, and setting up the board. You've mentioned the role of the board quite a bit.
Yes.
So it seems like a great one-stop shop, and sort of with the online tool combined to really guide a new or existing nonprofits through this world. I imagine that a lot of people also just want you personally. So how do we get a hold of you, Karen? How do we get a hold of Capacitate and hopefully, you know, get some nonprofits out there to access your expertise and your advice in navigating all this?
Oh, thank you, Kingsley. Well, Capacitate has a website, which is capacitate.co.za. And I think the best way to contact us is probably on email, which would be at info@capacitate.co.za.
Okay. I hope it's not one of those info sites where you never hear back from. I hope
no, you should hear back.
I hope somebody looks at this one. Karen, thank you so much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you for making time.
You're most welcome.
Fantastic. For everybody listening in, thank you, as usual, for taking time to hang out with us. As usual, you can share and download the podcast. A really, really big sort of day in politics on sort of the discussion around Jacob Zuma in Parliament today. Make sure to follow at Ranjani Munasami for all the details on that, and I'm sure we'll be chatting a bit about that next week. I'm out of time. I'm going to get sort of cut off any second now. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Cliff Central.
The revolution. I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.